from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 2 weeks ago, President Obama outlined a strategy for taking on ISIS, the Islamic State. U.S.-led airstrikes, regional partners, no American boots on the ground. Last week, Congress began appropriating funds for that effort. It's on. But there are still big questions about how and whether it will work, whether the pieces of a coalition will work together. This hour on Point, we're giving a tough going over to the new U.S. strategy on ISIS. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you think of President Obama's plan to take on ISIS, the Islamic State? Will it work? Does it add up? Do you have a better idea? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Speaking Saturday in his weekly radio address to the nation, here was President Obama laying out the very simple planks of his strategy to take on ISIS.
We will use our air power. We will train and equip our partners. We will advise and we will assist. And we'll lead a broad coalition of nations who have a stake in this fight.
All right. Simple formula, but not everybody sees it. Wednesday, in the House debate on financing Syrian rebels, this was Democratic Representative Loretta Sanchez, California, saying she was not going to vote in favor of the measure because she's concerned about how committed that coalition really is.
So the president says we have a coalition of 40. You know, it's interesting because I remember the Iraq War and the coalition. Some of our coalition members sent one person. I'd really like to know who our coalition is and what they're really going to do before I vote for any plan.
There are a lot of memories here of American engagement deep in this region, and very recently, one of those involved deeply at the time was Tony Blair, then British Prime Minister. He was on CNN's State of the Union yesterday suggesting that an aerial campaign might not ultimately be enough to defeat ISIS.
There will undoubtedly be over time a need to hit ISIS, not simply through an aerial campaign, but also on the ground. And the question will be, can those people, if they're supported locally, can they do that job, or will we have to supplement that?
Can they get the job done on the ground, whoever they may be? With us now from Orlando, Florida, retired Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, served in the U.S. Army for 37 years, commanded U.S. Task Force Iron in northern Iraq from 07 to 09 during what was called the Surge. He was chief war planner at the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2001 to 2003. That's an interesting stretch of time. Lieutenant General Mark Hertling, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's an honor to be here with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Stephen Simon, fellow at the Middle East Institute, professor of government at Dartmouth. He was senior director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs at the White House in President Obama's first term, former executive director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and co-author with Daniel Benjamin of the book The Next Attack, The Failure of the War on Terror, and A Strategy for Getting It Right. Stephen Simon, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here.
All right, so many questions, but let's just begin to wade in. Mark Hertling, let's just take a hypothetical first. If everything worked perfectly, as envisioned, as far as envisioned by the president in that strategy we just heard, could it work? Would it work?
I think it has the best chance of working, Tom. And just to dissolve any belief, a lot of it won't work, but some of it will. And I think the president has taken a very measured approach to the situation. He has not rushed into things, which I think he was being people were attempting to persuade him to do just that. But I think he has really garnered the support of his national security team and taken the best advice from his military commanders in terms of how to address the issue with ISIS in Syria and Iraq.
So you're saying thumbs up, American people, get behind this. This is the way to go. And it's got the best shot we've got of working.
Yeah, I would say that, Tom. And I'd also say to those who think we can just bomb our way out of this or put forces in contact and make sure that the American will is primary in the area, that doesn't work. It doesn't work culturally. It doesn't work linguistically in this area. It's a very difficult and complex situation. There are centuries of challenges here. And I think the president's plan which will go over decades, I would think, to counter Islamic extremism. In this case, it's this particular group that is just another one of the gangs that have come together, and they're the terrorist group du jour. The entire ideology has to be attacked and pushed down.
I've got lots of questions there, but Stephen Simon, let me come to you. Americans saw this country deeply engaged in Iraq, full on, all boots on the ground, all force in the sky for for more than a decade, and it apparently did not work. So how does this engagement light work?
Well, I think it works, in terms of specific objectives. I mean, I agree with General Hertling that there isn't much more that President Obama could have packed into his ISIS strategy in the absence of boots on the ground. An air campaign has already shown itself actually to be effective, at least in northern Iraq, where it succeeded in pushing ISIS forces, if I can phrase it that way, since it's not really an army. Push them away from Sinjar, push them away from Erbil, and push them away from the Mosul Dam. So, air power will get you somewhere. It doesn't get you everywhere because I think as a matter of military logic, you really have to have contact on the ground if you're going to maximize the effectiveness of your air power. And this is where the coalition comes in, or at least part of it, because I think in President Obama's or the administration's vision, the Iraqi army in Iraq will eventually provide the ground forces that will chip away at ISIS on the ground as the United States and possibly others, the French have already launched airstrikes, chip away from ISIS on the ground.
Why do you think the Iraqi army will bring that to bear when it so utterly failed in the initial advance of or onslaught of ISIS?
For a couple of reasons. And mind you, I'm not Pollyanna on this. I think it's going to be an uphill climb for the Iraqi army and for the U.S. that's now engaged in – re-engaged in training the army. But the country is under new leadership. Now, there's an elite that runs the country that's, in which the new leadership is embedded, and it's not clear if the entire elite that's running the country is on board with the new policies that the government under Haider al-Abadi has announced. But nevertheless, it's a new government. Their policies will differ, at least to some extent, from the preceding one, which hollowed out the army. Rendered it far less militarily effective and took actions vis-a-vis the Sunni population in the north and west that alienated it so profoundly that ISIS, was preferable to governance by the administration in Baghdad. So there is that. The Pentagon has said that about a third to a half, depending upon which study you've looked at, a third to a half of the Iraqi forces are good enough at this point for the United States at least to work with them. And taking into consideration the enormous size of the Iraqi army, a third to a half of it is still quite a lot. But none of this is going to happen instantaneously, and it will take a while. And in the meantime, the United States will be continuing to attack ISIS from the air, perhaps along with other powers that have the capacity to carry out such attacks.
Mark Hertling, General Hertling, how would you describe what we are getting back in the middle of here? What is the essential conflict that we're re-engaging with?
Well, we defined it when I went there in 2007 as a complex counterinsurgency. And that was before I took the headquarters and the forces that I had been allotted with me into northern Iraq. When we got there, we realized it was much more complex than we even imagined. There were, And this, by the way, was my second tour in Iraq after a time of 15 months in Baghdad, 2003 and 4. What was interesting in the northern area, you get a feel for the culture. There are seven major tribes in the north. There are 179, by our count, sub-tribes. There are gun runners who are just trying to make money. There are Sunni tribal chiefs who want power. There are former Ba'athists who realized that at the time the al-Maliki government was pushing them on the outside, so they ran counter to the central government in Baghdad. There are four Arab provinces, three Kurdish provinces just in northern Iraq alone, plus you add to that Anbar, which is primarily a Sunni province. It isn't all Sunni in the north. There are significant numbers of Shia.
Don't stick just to the north. We've got the west. We've got south. They've been near Baghdad. We've got Syria.
But when you look at the area where ISIS has really attempted to control, it is the north and the west of Iraq. They are trying to get into the south and come around from the southern side of Baghdad, which is understandable because there are some Sunni heartlands there too. But they are generating support from the tribal chiefs. And the sheikhs have said, hey, we will support this organization because we've received nothing from the central government. Now, I agree that the fact that Mr. al-Abadi has now been named the new prime minister, but you're talking about over 4 years of just trauma that the Iraqi people have withstood under Mr. Maliki. And before that, you're talking about decades of trauma. So really, the people in all areas of Iraq, they don't know which way to turn, and they need someone's trust and confidence, and they need to be considered as part of the equation.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour. Well, we're giving another kind of scrub here, another assessment to U.S. plans to take on ISIS, the Islamic State, looking at what makes sense, what may not, what can actually work. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you on board with the president's strategy, the president's plan? What if, as my guest, Lieutenant General retired Mark Hertling, says it takes decades? Will it work in those decades? Could it work sooner? Stephen Simon is with us as well. He is at Dartmouth these days, a professor of government there and co-author of The Next Attack, The Failure of the War on Terror and a Strategy for Getting It Right. Was in the White House during President Obama's first term as former senior director of Middle Eastern and North African Affairs there. Mark Hertling was in the middle of the Iraq War, commanded U.S. Task Force Iron in northern Iraq from 07 to 09, there during the surge, the Sunni awakening, did a couple of tours in Iraq. Here last Thursday on the Senate floor, Democratic Senator Robert Menendez, New Jersey, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said training and arming Syrian rebels for that part of it is the best option.
We must stand with our partners in the region to confront this barbarism in the interest of all the individuals being brutalized by ISIL, but also because regional stability and U.S. security demand it.
Same day, Senate floor, Senator John McCain, Republican Arizona, saying, not enough here. Boots on the ground, please.
I think that by continuing to repeat that the U.S. won't put boots on the ground, the president, in effect, traps himself. Now, that's the opinion not of John McCain and Lindsey Graham. It's the opinion of Robert Gates and every military expert I have talked to.
And the opinion, apparently, of Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. He was on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, calling for more military power in the fight against ISIS, or ISIL.
We totally misunderstand how you beat a group like ISIL. Military exercises are a shaping exercise to give the space in order to create political resolution there. And so our focus should be on enough military power in order to force changes on the ground in Iraq so that the Sunni moderates have a place to go other than ISIL.
Stephen Simon, General Hertling, please stand by. Let's get a couple calls here and we'll dive back in. Detroit, Michigan, Tom, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm definitely standing with the president because, I mean, we've just ended the Iraq war. We're drawing down in Afghanistan. And, I mean, I don't want to see the United States military lives put back in harm's way. And I say this, you know, we are not in this alone. We can't be in this alone. The other countries that are around that region, we're going to have to join forces. And if anything, let's go ahead and ramp up the doggone bombing and just, you know, bomb them into submission. That's me personally. But boots on the ground, Unequivocally, no.
What if regional partners on the ground can't get the job done, the ground part of it, Tom?
All I'm saying is I don't want to see the military lives put back in danger. I say just continue the bombing. Just ramp it up. Crank it up and continue to bomb.
There's a lot of desert out there. But Tom, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, and I'll bring it to my guest, Jonathan, in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Jonathan, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good, thank you. What do you think?
First off, I'd just like to say that I don't agree with President Obama's plan. Biggest reason why is just using the airstrikes, we're essentially giving ISIS a propaganda tool. The longer that they're alive and surviving, the more that they're able to say that they're surviving against the United States, therefore recruiting more members, because we already have a problem with them recruiting abroad, U.S., French, German citizens. With that, I do think we have to put boots on ground. We need to take the fight to them. Coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan, myself included, we have a lot of experienced guys that are more than willing to go.
Jonathan, what service were you in there?
I'm in the Army currently.
And what's the attitude of your fellow members of the Army? President Obama went to Central Command, CENTCOM, and seemed very careful to assure the U.S. military that it would not be boots on the ground, as if the U.S. military wants to hear that.
Well, like I said, myself, my coworkers, included many of them, they want to go. They're more than willing to volunteer. They've already beheaded U.S. citizens. To me, that's more than enough to go over there, as well as they're already threatening our security. They're sending out messages for internal cells within the United States to go ahead and go out and start conducting the attacks. Then they had the other cells in Australia with the plan to kidnap people off the street.
Yeah, that news we saw that last week. Jonathan, I appreciate your call. Ready to go. And yet we've got a lot of experience that tells us lots went, and it didn't exactly make a perfect setting. In fact, here comes ISIS. One more, James in Hershey, Pennsylvania. James, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I would like to just say I served in Desert Shield and Desert Storm in the Navy, and I don't really agree with the bombings. The state of affairs over there, I mean, this is over decades, if not centuries, of infighting. You've got a ISIS or Islamic State entity that is, they're barbarians to say the least. However, their ideology is what ramps up that region. And to get them to change that, bombing them, sending troops, that's not going to change the mentality that's over there.
So what would you do then, James? Sorry. Thanks.
What I would do is I would implore the people that live in that region to take arms. Once they have enough, then they will fight back. But if we keep going over there and, innocent kids, they see what's going on but don't really understand, that's how the seed of hate towards the West is planted.
You mean when American bombs come down?
American bombs, American troops, when all of that is done, younger generations there don't understand why, and they get this hate towards the West. My suggestion is let them fight their own battles. I mean, we can't police the world. I understand what they're doing is wrong, and what they're doing is cruel. However, people that live there have got to stand up for themselves.
James, I appreciate your call as well. Mark Hertling, General Hertling, let me put that range of listener views to you. And in particular, there with James saying, people are going to see those bomber jets overhead, and it's not going to create a welcome culture on the ground for American goals. We should stay out, let the region deal with its own problem here.
Yeah, Tom, let me address a couple of things, because those were all three great questions. The first one about the comment about, hey, there's lots of deserts out there. Let's go in and just bomb them. Well,
in any kind of desert warfare, air power is critically important. But you also have to consider that in the area we're talking about, there are major cities. The town of Mosul, as an example, has a population of almost 2 million people. So if we start bombing inside of Mosul as ISIS goes into that city, we're going to have an awful lot of civilian casualties who are not wanting to be a part of this campaign. The second thing, I remember your last caller made a comment, let them fight it out on their own. One of the things I learned, I was talking to the provincial governor of Diyala province, the province closest to Baghdad, and he was attending one of our soldiers' memorial services. He was a strong supporter of the United States. And through a translator, he told me, and I hope it translated correctly, he said, the problem with the fight, and this was in 2008, the problem with the fight, General Hertling, is he says, you want it more than we do. And he says, until Iraq wants this and wants security and wants a representative government more than you do, this will continue on. And I think that's the critical piece. And it was an awakening moment for me where an Iraqi was saying, we have to stand up. And I think that's what the president is trying to push as part of his strategy, that this is dependent on them to secure their people, to secure their land, and to get rid of this horrible, horrific 15th century barbaric group.
But Stephen Simon, is that going to happen when, yes, you've got Iraq, still very troubled after the war there, and on either side you've got Iran and Saudi Arabia, who, Shia and Sunni, who have seen themselves as locked in a kind of regional struggle for dominance. How does Iraq decide, you know, that it wants it more than anybody else when it's divided within and it's got external powerful supporters promoting the very division that lets ISIS thrive?
Yeah, well, it's going to be quite difficult. I mean, look, the U.S. initially fought the war in Iraq in very violent and somewhat indiscriminate ways. Now, I don't mean that as a criticism, really. Because, you know, armies have doctrines and missions and objectives, and they approach them in what they think is going to be the most effective way possible. And the way we fought the war in those first few years contributed to the rise of the very serious insurgency that was later quelled by the surge. Now, the surge worked because there was a complete reformatting of American military strategy. But that required a new defense secretary in Washington. It required President Bush, who was desperate at that point to fix things in Iraq, or at least to reverse a very negative trend. And it required an entirely new military leadership, U.S. military leadership in Baghdad.
But what's the relevance of the surge? The surge itself was about more U.S. troops. This time we're going to have none,
yeah,
we're told.
But it's not so much the number of troops that were deployed in the surge, but how they carried out the battle. And they carried out the battle in terms of a counterinsurgency doctrine that relied on protection of the native population, taking care of its needs, and so forth, and really going after in a very discriminating way that limited collateral damage, going after the bad guys.
Can we do that without American troops in there? American troops,
well, that's
what surge meant. It meant more troops back in. I'm not saying that's a good idea necessarily, but that was the heart of the surge, that plus the awakening dynamic.
Yes, I agree. But my point here is that that's going to be very, very difficult for the Iraqis to do. In other words, if our ability to do it required such dramatic changes in Washington, in Baghdad, and in our military doctrine, I think it's a lot to expect of the Iraqis, and I think it will take them a long time to get there if they ever do.
So why do you say this is a good strategy if the central portion of it, which is right there where your finger is right now, is so dubious?
Oh, I think it's really problematic. And, you know, if the Iraqis do fight the war in a way that only worsens the underlying grievances, then ISIS is going to get a new lease on life. Now, the Iraqi government has already started to take steps to reverse some of the things that were so alienating in the Sunni provinces, particularly the use of indiscriminate fire. If they thought that ISIS or terrorists were in a particular place, they just shelled the whole area and killed a lot of people, a lot of innocent people unnecessarily. So they are getting the message, and we are pounding – the U.S. is pounding that message home in Baghdad. But still, it's going to be an uphill climb, and we just have to accept that. And we have to accept the fact that no strategy is perfect, and we have to accept the fact, I think, that what we do in Iraq or maybe eventually in Syria has to somehow be commensurate with U.S. interests and the actual threat posed by ISIS. And I think there's been a tremendous inflation of the threat of ISIS, which is reflected in the latest polls of American public opinion, which show that a majority of Americans think that they've never been more unsafe since 9/11. That, to me, is quite incredible, especially after the United States has spent billions – I mean literally billions – building the Homeland Security Department from scratch and strengthening American defenses in a way that they simply didn't exist before 9/11. Now, do we have any confidence at all in what we've done? This, to me, is really troubling. And within the region, I'm not really sure what the broader threat of ISIS is to U.S. interests. I think it would be difficult, if not impossible, for them to invade Jordan. We're already responding to them in Iraq. They can't take Turkey. They're not going to invade Iran. And Hezbollah will keep them out of Lebanon. And the Israelis, I don't think, are, you know, trembling in their boots.
What does all that suggest? Go ISIS even lighter? Threat. Don't even get into this air campaign?
Well, you know, you might ask that. But I think, you know, the president in the administration is under tremendous pressure because of the way in which this threat has been pumped up to take action. And I think, you know, it's true, as the administration has said, that the United States has an interest in Iraq. We spent a huge amounts of blood and treasure. We'd like to see Iraq emerge as a stable country after that. And therefore, we ought to do something to help Iraq defeat ISIS, which is what we're doing. But we don't want to overinvest and don't need to, in part because ISIS, for demographic reasons alone, can't really topple the government in Baghdad. And
though they really got things
General
going,
Hertling said, they can be contained.
Well, I mean, 130,000, we hear, refugees over the border into Turkey just over the last 4 days. They've got things moving. General Hertling, what about it? The president, described here by Stephen Simon, as kind of stampeded into this. Do you share that view that it's not that big a threat? It may be unnecessary. And if it is a significant threat and you've got to have harmony and unity to bring a coalition together and drive them out, how do you get that between Saudi Arabia and Iran, such big, powerful neighbors?
Yeah, I would probably say I agree partly with the fact that there has been much political, media, and congressional pressure and American public pressure on the president to do something. But I think, again, I go back to the point where I think he's doing the right things. He's taken a measured approach. I believe what we'll see in the future is probably a strategic offensive against ISIS in Syria, where it will be precision bombings of key nodes. That will probably happen within the next 1 to 2 weeks. I think we're going to go on a strategic defensive in Iraq, much like we did during the surge period, that would give the Iraqi government time to again get their act together. And I think in 2008, 2009, they were beginning to get their act together until the sectarian issues took place.
Who's going to come in behind a strategic bombing in Syria?
I don't think anybody is.
So what's
the point
of it, then?
Strategic bombing. Well, it's to blunt ISIS's ability to conduct operations while simultaneously conducting ground force operations from the Iraqi security forces, from the Peshmerga, from any other contributing nation in Iraq that might blunt them there.
We heard General Dempsey.
This has got to be a war of attrition, not annihilation. This will not happen in a week's time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're giving another scrub this hour, another what assessment to U.S. plans to take on ISIS, looking at what makes sense here, what may not, what can actually work, how long it might take, what are the odds of success here, with retired Lieutenant General Mark Hertling. He was right in the middle of the Iraq War, planning execution, joins us today from Orlando, Florida. Stephen Simon is with us. He was executive director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, was former senior director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs at the White House in the first term of President Obama, co-author with Daniel Benjamin of The Next Attack, The Failure of the War on Terror, and A Strategy for Getting It Right. President Obama expressing gratitude after the Senate joined the House in signing off on money for training Syrian rebels, so-called moderate Syrian rebels, to fight against ISIS, hailing the bipartisan vote here.
I'm pleased that Congress, a majority of Democrats and a majority of Republicans in both the House and the Senate, have now voted to support a key element of our strategy, our plan to train and equip the opposition in Syria so they can help push back these terrorists.
There you go. There's the plan. We're going to go to Ahmad and Khalidi in 1 minute here. One more caller, Mitch in Denver, Colorado. Mitch, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think, Mitch?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I think a completely different strategy needs to happen here. I think we should get out. Get out of Iraq, get out of Syria, get out of Afghanistan.
What do you think would happen if we do that? How do you picture this turning out?
Well, it's their own regional war. Doing blanket bombing didn't work in Vietnam, and the country didn't stabilize until we left.
Get out.
Now we have trade with Vietnam.
All right. Get out. Let them do it. It's theirs. Let us pick that up, if I may. And Mitch, thanks for your call from Denver with Ahmad Khalidi. He's a visiting scholar at St. Anthony's College at Oxford, former Palestinian peace negotiator, but watching this whole region right now, along with people all over the world. Ahmad Khalidi, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
What is this conflict at heart? What's the coalition getting in the middle of here?
Well, I think this is a multi-front war. If you try to unpeel the kind of onion layers of conflict that are going on, you will come up with 15, maybe 20 different conflicts ranging from the personal to the socioeconomic. So there is a very broad range of underlying struggles and conflicts. But I think what we're seeing at the moment is a number of things are being highlighted. On the one hand, you have a sectarian conflict that is within Islam, the two branches of Islam, the main branches of Islam, Sunni and Shiite. There is this sectarian or confessional conflict that has been ignited in Syria. It sprung from various local animosities and regional struggles for power and influence, but it is now perhaps the dominant struggle. And that's got an overlay of power between state-to-state power struggle between some of the Arab Gulf countries, in particular Saudi Arabia, and on the other hand, Iran. So you have a sectarian conflict, you have a state-to-state conflict, but you also have within that, there's another core conflict, which is, if you like, within the ideology of Wahhabism, which is the ideology which is the connecting link, as it were, between ISIS and the Saudi regime. ISIS and its ilk, including Al-Qaeda, who is the kind of mother formation, arose out of the same tree, they are branches of the same religious ideological tree that sustains the Saudi regime on the one hand, and that has grown into, in its more extreme forms, into these kind of terrorist organizations. And so there's a kind of inter-family struggle for legitimacy within Wahhabism, if you like, alongside everything else that's happening.
Let me ask you about, there's a kind of family feud then, all right. If at some level this is...
That's not to belittle it.
You know, no, I don't mean to.
It can be sometimes the worst kind of feud.
Of course. But if at some level this is a fight between moderates and extremists, would you see it that way? Does the Islamic world see it that way? And if it is,
the
U.S. stayed out, who would win?
No, I hesitate to use these terms. I'm not sure they are relevant in this context.
Okay.
The Saudi regime, in many ways, has extreme aspects to its its practices at home. May be worth remembering or mentioning that in the last month alone in Saudi Arabia, you had a large number of people executed, including eight beheaded for charges ranging from adultery to apostasy to sorcery. So beheading is not the sole prerogative of ISIS, unfortunately. I would hesitate to use that, and I'd hesitate most of all in trying to look at another aspect of this, which only came in at the very late tail end of the conversation mm-hmm. I was listening into, which has to do fundamentally with Syria and the so-called moderates in Syria. And I think this campaign is going to be decided largely, I believe, in Syria and not in Iraq. In Iraq, you already have a significant coalition, which is made up of government forces, it's made up of Shiite militia, and it's made up of an alliance with the Kurds. And these, backed by the United States, by United States air power, and backed by most Arab countries, has as good a chance as any other force on the ground to defeat or at least initially contain ISIS. So the issue for me is not one about boots on the ground from the American perspective, at least not in Iraq, that's for sure. And when it comes to Syria, this is a different ballgame, because even if you contain or are able to inflict significant damage to ISIS in Iraq, they will shift simply to Syria. And as long as Syria is a kind of safe haven for ISIS in Iraq, then no matter what you do in Iraq, you will always have the soft underbelly. The western borders of Iraq will always be open to infiltration.
What ground forces, Ahmed Khalidi, are going to go into Syria and change the equation on the ground there, even with a rain of American bombing?
Certainly not American ground forces. I don't think that's a good idea. The history of American or Western military intervention in the region is a very unhappy one.
Yep. So who?
Going back, if you like, to 1956 mm-hmm. and the British and French invasion of Egypt. We don't want to repeat that. I don't think this is on the cards. You already have the Syrian army on the ground, force that is the largest, the most effective, and the one that has the most incentive to defeat ISIS. It seems to me the height of strategic folly for the United States to start bombing Syria and open a new front against the only effective boots-on-the-ground force that is likely to do the job. Just as you have a coalition in Iraq that's made up of the Iraqi army, the Shiite militia, and the Kurds, you should encourage a similar coalition based on the Syrian army, with the Kurds, and with the Shiite militias, and if I dare say so, including Hezbollah, which has proven to be perhaps the most effective anti-terrorist force in the world today.
Backed by Tehran, of course.
Yes, in some form of cooperation and understanding with Iran. I'm not suggesting that you have to sit down with Hafez al-Assad, receive him at the White House, on the White House lawn, with Texan marching, Texan marching band. Yep. I don't think what's required here is an embrace of Assad. But it seems to me ridiculous and a folly to be bombing Syria in a manner that will put you in conflict with Assad.
But Mr. Khalidi, if the U.S. follows that, if they team up, in effect, with Assad and Hezbollah, both of these deeply supported by Iran, won't you have Saudi Arabia the next day looking to undercut this whole effort?
Which you already have that, because Saudi Arabia is fighting its own war for legitimacy, as I said, with the Wahhabis. They have no choice. They will have no choice, because for them, the alternative, which is to hand over power and legitimacy to the jihadist extremists who are on their as it were right flank,
yep.
it would be in my opinion more one of the problems here, which we haven't touched, is that when we look at the nature of the threat that ISIS poses, and I agree with Steve Simon, I think it has been exaggerated, but the threat that ISIS poses is not simply about Western interests. It's about what it represents for the region itself. And the threat that it represents to the standing order in Saudi Arabia. Yes, this is a branch of Wahhabism, but it is also in direct conflict with it.
General Hertling, let me come to you, if I may, on Ahmed Khalidi's assertion here that it will be ultimately necessary and maybe inevitable that the U.S. teams up with Assad and even Hezbollah. What do you say, General Hertling?
I don't see that happening. And in fact, I think that's part of the nuance of the president's plan. You know, I think a lot of people, when they heard about the Admiral Kirby briefing how long it would take to train the Free Syrian Army,
a
were appalled
plus, yeah.
that it would take that long. But I think that's part of the plan. I mean, again, going back to the strategic defensive and the blunting of ISIS and the continued attrition of them in Iraq while conducting operations against key strategic nodes in Syria gives time for that new for the Free Syrian Army to be built up.
But their goal is to take Assad out, not to defeat ISIS.
But I think their first goal will be to survive against ISIS. So when they are replaced in that area and they have the strength that they might get from this training within Saudi Arabia, their first desire, I think, is to defeat their competitors, their key competitors, which will be ISIS. And by that time, if the plan is going according to schedule, ISIS will be attrited significantly. And that will eventually lead to the potential use of the Free Syrian Army against the Assad regime.
Stephen Simon, embrace this formal Syrian army, Assad's army now, maybe in Hezbollah, because they have the force and the motivation to really go after ISIS, or go on this slow, maybe it'll work, train up the moderates, and then we'll see, path. Which do you say?
Well, if they have the force and the motivation to go after ISIS, then they're just going to go after ISIS. I mean, I don't really see a pressing need for a coordination, formal or informal, with either.
Assad will do it even if we don't coordinate with them?
I mean, there's a convergence of interest here. So, you know, they'll do what's in their interest. Hezbollah, of course, is already doing it, and they're considering an eastward deployment of their forces now in Syria to take on ISIL or ISIS directly. Yep. So, you know, that's already happening. We don't need the kind of tactical or operational coordination that I think some people are suggesting.
Mr. Khalidi, they're on our side. Assad, whether we say so or not, we don't have to worry about it. They'll go after ISIS. Let them go. What do you say? Ahmed Khalidi.
Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am.
Yes. I think, with due respect to Steve Simon, I think the issue is not that the Assad regime will go after ISIS anyway. Yes, they will. The issue is what happens when the United States starts bombing Syria against the will of the Syrian government and thus puts itself, amongst other things, in confrontation with the regime.
Why would it be against the will if
the
it's
allies?
If it's narrowly targeted at ISIS, wouldn't they welcome that, the Assad forces?
Nothing, you know, as we should learn from our experiences, you know, the idea that you're going to go in and just do a surgical operation or two and then things will stop there, it doesn't work like that. Once you embark on a sustained bombing campaign on Syrian soil against the will of the Syrian regime, you are going to come up against all sorts of problems, not least of which, by the way, will be the reaction of the Russians and the Iranians. So this to me makes no sense whatsoever. If you have a convergence of interest, try and make use of it. Use it as a lever. Lever it into your policy so that you can influence Assad in the future. Which is better, to be bombing Assad now or to be using your force with Assad in such a way that you can have influence with him later on?
One call right here. Jonathan, Austin, Texas. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Isn't it a time for us to finally recognize the Kurds and grant them a state and give them real weapons, tanks, anti-tank weapons, things that they can use to fight? They're the boots on the ground. They're highly motivated. There's millions of them. They've been tortured, raped, and murdered by ISIS, and it's time to recognize them. I understand we have concerns about Turkey and Iraq and so forth, but the national lines there are vanishing. President Obama himself said this. The lines drawn down in 1917 with the Balfour Agreement, they don't mean anything. The Kurds are waiting to fight, and we're starving them that we throw a few AK-47s.
Jonathan, let us pick it up. Ahmed Khalidi, what about the Kurds here? Arm them up, let them go, and they'll take care of the on-the-ground portion.
By all means, but I think there's a couple of points here. First, the Kurds will only fight for Kurdistan. I think you have a bigger issue here. And second, the very idea that you're going to support an independent Kurdish state will put you at odds with some of your closest allies, specifically Turkey and Iraq, but perhaps even more Turkey than Iraq. And so this would be an enormous risk in terms of your relationship with one of the major powers in the region and a party that you need in this broader struggle for stability in Iraq and Syria. So while you may help things by arming the Kurds, defending or supporting the idea of Kurdish independence will put you in conflict with your biggest potential allies.
General Hertling, this is such a Rubik's Cube of interests, many of them conflicting interests. Do you think the U.S. is on the right path? And you're talking decades here. Will those be decades in which we're creating an atmosphere that leads this region toward peace?
I think you will see a continued growth of various terrorist groups. ISIS is just the most recent one and probably the most horrific we've seen in a long time. But there are certainly others waiting in the wing. And I think Ahmed's comment about the potential of tamping down the ideology, the Wahhabist, the Salafist ideology, is critically important to this whole debate. And unfortunately,
but it's at the heart of the Saudi Arabian regime.
It is at the heart of many of the regimes. And again, if your last caller who suggested the Kurds be a part of this, I would agree completely, except for the fact that I've worked extensively with the Kurds, and I understand their political drive too, and it's to gain more territory. So yeah, this is complex, Tom. There are no easy solutions. It will take a long time, and there will be follow-up organizations like Khorasan, with the most recent one in Syria, that will follow ISIS if we don't address the ideology issue.
Stephen Simon, are you heartened by the opening trajectory of this or not?
Well, I agree with General Hertling that the president's strategy is the right one. I think it's consistent with the scale of American interest and the nature of the threat. But we need to bear in mind that the underlying issues are deep, they're structural, they're socioeconomic in nature, and they are so far beyond the ability of the United States and its allies to remedy.
We're out of time right there. I apologize. Stephen Simon, Mark Hertling, Ahmad Khalidi, thanks. This is On Point.